This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In Chicago this week, all nine Democratic presidential hopefuls vied for the support of the AFL-CIO, the Federation of Organized Unions that represents 13 million workers. Missouri Congressman Dick Gephardt was the leading candidate to win the group's endorsement, but at the end of the two-day meeting, the AFL-CIO announced it would not endorse any of them, at least not now. In a weak economy, health care, givebacks, and job security were important items of discussion in Chicago, along with politics. But maybe the most important meetings on those issues were the current negotiations between the country's largest phone company, Verizon, and its 78,000 union workers. Membership in labor unions has been falling steadily for decades now. Just over 16 million workers belong to unions today. 40 years ago, when John F. Kennedy was president, 17.5 million workers were unionized in a workforce less than half the size that it is now. We want to hear from you this hour, union member or not. Are unions important, counterproductive, or irrelevant where you work? Do you pay any attention to union endorsements of political candidates? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now for an update on several of these issues is Stephen Greenhouse. He writes about labor and workplace issues for the New York Times, and he's with us from his office in Manhattan. Welcome.
Hello, Neil. How are you?
Coughing my brains out at the moment. Excuse me, just a second. Ah, those little buttons come in handy. Excuse me. Wanted to ask you to start, Stephen. Was it a surprise to you that Dick Gephardt did not get the endorsement of the AFL-CIO meeting in Chicago?
In truth, no, Neil. Because to get the AFL-CIO's endorsement, a candidate needs support of unions representing two-thirds of the members. And as someone who watches it fairly closely, it was clear that most unions have not made up their decisions yet. Over the next month or two, a lot of unions will be making up their decisions. So right now, about 30% unions representing maybe 30% of union members support Gephardt, and we'll probably see many other unions supporting him. But I don't think he'll get to the two-thirds point.
The Teamsters are expected to announce their endorsement this weekend, right?
Yes.
Gephardt has been a loyal union activist in the Congress, has been a staunch supporter on union issues. Why the wavering?
For several reasons. Some union leaders are attracted to people like Dean and Kerry. They think those are worthwhile candidates. Also, some union leaders, as much as they like Gephardt, worry that he's not the guy with the best chance of beating Bush. That's why some union leaders look at Edwards, look at Kerry, look at Dean. And, of course, there are also concerns about Gephardt's weak showing on fundraising in the second quarter. I think that put a lump in the throat of some union leaders who really support Gephardt. That made them worry that maybe, you know, he's not the guy.
It's important to remember, as we look at the Democratic nominating process, the first big elections are in Iowa, and the caucuses there, and then, of course, New Hampshire. Both of those big union states.
Well, New Hampshire actually is not a big union state. Iowa is a very big union state. And in Iowa, in the caucuses, union members represented one-third of the delegates, which is extremely impressive showing. In New Hampshire in 2000, when the AFL-CIO endorsed Gore, union members represented a quarter of the Democrats who voted in the primary, which is pretty extraordinary because unions do not represent close to that in the state. This
all
goes to show that despite unions' weakness in the economic sphere, in the political sphere, they're disproportionately strong.
Let's talk for a second about California. Just 2 days ago, the California Labor Federation threw its support behind Governor Gray Davis and indicated that it would never forget any other Democrat who jumped into the recall battle. And that is just what Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante has now done, ignoring the implied threat of the union. It's not very implied either, pretty open threat. What does that say about union influence, at least in California?
It's hard to say. My guess is 2 days ago, the sense among many Democrats in California, and in truth I haven't followed this that closely, was that let Davis, you know, there should be no other Democrat on the ballot. Just let Davis stand or fall on his own. I think when Schwarzenegger entered the race, many people thought, aha, there's a greater chance that Davis will be recalled. We'll lose, I think, more and more Democrats, including probably some labor people said, hey, it's important to get at least one prominent Democrat on the ballot in case Davis is recalled. And I would think that Bustamante would not have agreed to enter the race unless he checked it with some of his labor friends, who probably winked and said, go ahead, it's okay.
Bring us up to date, if you would, on the Verizon negotiations, and what are the key issues in those talks?
The two main issues are job security / flexibility, two sides of the same coin, and Second is health care. On health care, Verizon is suffering the way many, many other companies are suffering. Health costs are rising 10, 12, 14% a year, and Verizon says it's only fair that the workers contribute more towards health insurance. The workers, of course, the unions, of course, say Verizon's very profitable. Why should we pay more? And Verizon says we should shoulder this increased burden together.
Mm-hmm.
Second, on job security flexibility, the company says that it faces huge and fierce competition in the telecom sector. There, has been a telecom slump now for 3-4 years. Verizon is sort of facing a profit squeeze. It's facing huge competition in wireless. Its normal hardline landline phone service is shrinking. And it says it needs more flexibility to reduce and relocate its workforce. Now, the union responds that, hey, this company made $4 billion in profits last year. It was able to reduce its workforce by 15,000 through attrition and through buyouts. So the union says it has plenty of flexibility. Why change the existing job security provisions?
And as I understand it, the contract had run out already, and the people are still at work, though the last time this happened, they went out on strike.
Yes. Well, I had a very unhappy time last Saturday night when I was waiting until midnight to see whether they were going to walk out that night, and they decided to extend the negotiations. And they've been extended and extended and extended, and my editors keep asking me, when are we going to see a white puff of smoke?
Can I ask the same question?
My editors just asked me 5 minutes ago. My sense is there will not be a settlement today. They are haggling, wrestling over, specific contractual language. I quoted a union official today saying it's like watching paint dry. The negotiations could well last several more days. They could last to the weekend. Conceivably, we'll have an agreement tomorrow, but I would not be at all surprised if it goes into next week.
Stephen Greenhouse, thanks very much. We'll watch for that puff of smoke.
Okay.
Stephen Greenhouse covers labor and workplace issues for the New York Times, and he spoke to us today from his office in Manhattan. And joining us now from member station KOPB in Portland, Oregon, is Michael Yates, a labor economist and the author of the book Why Unions Matter, and good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Good to be here, Neil.
The issues we just heard Stephen Greenhouse talking about, health care costs and job security, it seems that Verizon is not the only company where those are the key issues for labor.
No, those are big issues because employers have structured their workplace in such a way so that it's increasingly easy to replace workers by outsourcing with new technology, use of part-time workers, and so on and so forth. So security is a big issue for workers today, especially when unemployment is high. I'm here in Portland, Oregon. It's got the highest unemployment rate of any major city in the nation right now, nearly 9%, and tons of people are unemployed. So security is a big issue. And, of course, health care is a gigantic issue because we got, 40 million people without health care in the United States? That's a real big issue. And as employers insist that workers cover more and more of the health care costs, unions have a duty to try to stop that if they can.
Unions would seem to be fundamentally weaker in a weak economy.
Yes, that's normally the case. The only exception would be like if you have a catastrophe in the economy, like in the Great Depression, when people's whole way of thinking about things changes, then unions can grow. But normally, good times are better for unions and bad times are worse. In bad times, workers are very fearful about losing their jobs, and so it seems especially risky to join a union or support a union organizing campaign, especially given the poor state of the labor laws in the country.
And given the fact that Republicans control both houses of Congress and the White House, from a union's point of view, those laws are not likely to improve.
No, the laws aren't going to improve. But what's worse is that the enforcement of the existing laws will get worse because the president has the power to appoint the people that are on the National Labor Relations Board, for example. And And the National Labor Relations Board helps set the tone for the labor law's enforcement.
Power and influence of unions, if you look at the membership numbers, is in decline, but it's not always been that way.
No, unions reach their peak, I suppose, in terms of the percentage of non-supervisory wage and salary workers that are in unions in the middle of the 1950s, probably about a third. It's now 13.2%. You said a little over 16 million workers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's down 280,000 from last year. And in 1983, even, union density was about 20%.
And density, you mean percentage of the workforce?
That's the percentage of the people who are employed, non-supervisory workers, people who could be in unions who are employed that are actually in unions.
Okay. Let's get our callers involved. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address TOTN@NPR.org. Are unions important or irrelevant where you work? What is going on with union activity in whichever industry you work? And also, do you care about their endorsements of political candidates? Let's go first to Megan, and she joined us from Durham, North Carolina.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I'm calling today because the organization that I work for is actually undergoing a union vote right now as we speak. We should find out later this evening whether or not the position that I hold is going to be a unionized position.
Mm-hmm.
I work for a nonprofit social health organization. We specialize in public health. We run public hotlines for the Centers for Disease Control, and we were approached by the Boilermakers Union to unionize the health communications specialist positions.
And has this been a contentious process?
It has been. There's been a lot of drama going on with the organization. There have been lots of flyers printed up and left in the break room by people for both sides, union and not. And, you know, it has gotten kind of nasty. It's still been pretty silent because we're not supposed to talk about it, but it has been pretty nasty and pretty uncomfortable.
Megan, as long as you're willing to talk, can you tell us which way you voted?
I actually voted no. I don't want it. I don't think that we need it. I think that our management, I think they're fabulous. Of course there are problems. Everybody has problems at work. But I think that our management does a fantastic job. And while I've only been there for a short period of time since December, I'm really happy. I really love my job, and I really love the people that I work for. I think they do a good job, and I don't think that we need a union.
And so if you had to guess how the vote would come out, what do you think?
Gosh, you know, I actually asked that of somebody earlier today, and, you know, I'm really not sure. Now, I know that about 2 years ago, we actually underwent this process before with, if I'm not mistaken, I believe it was the same union, the same Boilermakers union, and they voted no last time. I'm hoping it goes the same way because I think that that could really create a lot of problems for us, and one of those problems would be that we're actually in the process of recompeting for our contract with the Centers for Disease Control,
mm-hmm.
and I think that if we were suddenly unionized, I think that could actually cause a lot of problems with our contract recompete.
Would costs go up, or would management make that argument?
Well, I think that part of those problems would be that the union would want to pay us more. You know, we don't make millions. You know, we certainly don't have six-figure salaries here. But, you know, what we get paid is decent. And the CDC only has so much money that they can pay us in terms of our wages. And I think that, you know, the union wanting to pay us more is going to create some problems for us.
Well, Megan, thanks very much. And, we'll have to wait and see how the election comes out. But I hope you come out well either way.
Thanks. We'll find out this evening. So
appreciate
thanks
it.
For having me.
Bye-bye.
I love your show.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll continue talking with Michael Yates, a labor economist, about the state of the union movement today. Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing labor unions. How relevant are they? How much political clout do they have? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn at npr.org. With us from member station KOPB in Portland, Oregon, is Michael Yates, a labor economist, the author of Why Unions Matter. And, Michael, just before the break, we were talking with a caller from North Carolina who's got an authorization vote underway at her shop. And I'm wondering, how are unions doing in these kinds of elections at various workplaces around the country? Is there any gauge of that?
Well, I think probably they're winning fewer than half of these certification elections, they're called. And even if they win, it's very difficult to get that first contract. So that ebbs and flows, you know, but it's not nearly as good as it used to be. That's for sure.
Get another.
And by the way, I wanted to mention North Carolina has the lowest of that percentage of workers organized in the country, 3.2%. It's at the absolute bottom of the barrel.
As the shape of which industries are unionized has really changed in this country over time. Used to be the base was in manufacturing. Is it now in government and office workers?
I would say that it's shifted towards workers in the service sector to some extent and workers in the public sector. In the public sector, about 37.5% of employees, non-supervisory employers, are unionized, about 7.2 million workers, whereas in the private sector, it's only 8.5%, and that's worse than it was in 1930.
Let's go to Paul, who's on the line with us from St. Louis, Missouri.
Hi, hello.
Hello, you're on the air, Paul.
Oh, great, thanks. I just wanted to call in respect to unions in the educational field. This will be my second year teaching the public school system here in Missouri, and I think that unions, you asked about if they were viable or not. I wanted to say I think they're very viable, especially to educators. In a situation where, you know, a young educator who's not making much money, especially in high school, could be, I think, sued or litigated against at any time. I think unions provide a lot of protection there. So that's my comment. My question is, being in education and probably one of the lowest paid, quote unquote, white collar professions in the country, and a profession that's getting considerable cuts right now. Why do you think educational unions are receive so much flack from conservatives concerning them being more concerned with money than the education of students in this country?
Michael Yates.
Well, actually, it's not just conservatives. I mean, I used to do some labor education, and it was surprising to me that even auto workers that I was teaching one time near Pittsburgh just drive them wild when school teachers went on strike. And I used to say to them, well, look, these school teachers who used to be very poorly paid, who used to have to leave their job, women, when they got pregnant, these unions have been very successful in organizing their workers, improving their standard of living, raising their wages, giving them health care, giving them some dignity in the workplace. So that's all to the good. So if you have union workers that are bad-mouthing public school teachers' unions, what can you expect from conservatives? Naturally, they're going to do it. Besides, I mean, that's all part of the conservative agenda, I suppose, whereby they think that public schools are indoctrinating youth and so on and so forth. And if the school teachers are organized and aggressive, they might impart some of those views to their students. I mean, I don't think there's very much truth to that. But that's probably one of the reasons, and also I think it's part of the conservative agenda to privatize and cut back, and unions are seen as a danger to that sort of thinking. I think conservatives would like there to be no public schools. They'd like for there only to be private schools, or to vastly expand the voucher system so students can go to private schools. They want to defund the public schools, it seems to me, and so unions are seen as a vocal voice against that happening, and so I think that's one of the reasons why conservatives are so opposed to public school teachers' unions.
I fear the day when there's no public schools in this country, that's for sure.
Well, Paul, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We have just received news from California that Republican Congressman Daryl Issa, the wealthy businessman who funded the petition drive and brought about the recall election against Governor Gray Davis, has now decided to pull out of the governor's race. He was on the second part of the ballot, so if Governor Davis had been recalled, he was among the many candidates hoping to replace him. And so the man who started the ball rolling has now withdrawn his candidacy in the California governor's race. We will have much more on this story. Obviously, Arnold Schwarzenegger and Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante announced their candidacy for that job last night. That transformed the race. Much more on that later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. Let's continue our conversation now now about unions. And one of the most celebrated stories of union organizing took place a few years ago now at the ivy-covered walls of Harvard University. Joining us now from his office in Boston is Aaron Bartley, a union organizer for the Service Employees International Union. He was instrumental in that effort, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Neil. Thanks for having me.
Can you briefly remind us what happened at Harvard?
Sure. It was a three-year period of organizing among students, workers, and faculty members at the university around the problem of low wages in the service sector. Workers such as janitors and cafeteria workers in the world's most wealthy university were being paid essentially poverty wages, wages that didn't allow them to pay rent and put food on the table and raise a family in a decent context.
As I recall, the campaign was for a living wage.
That's correct, and we defined a living wage at that time as $11 an hour, and even that is insufficient, in especially in a context like Boston, where rents are rising so quickly that just to keep up with the basic cost of living requires $12 and $13 an hour. We, over the three-year period, had some success. A great amount of success, finally, when we took over the administration's headquarters in Harvard Yard and brought the problem to the public fore. And I would suggest that of the union strategies that are working most well at this point are those unions that concentrate on direct action, on bringing problems to the public through strategies that were used in the 1930s, picketing, strikes, and getting away from just pure negotiation, which I think was something that unions had fallen into since the 1950s.
You're continuing to organize janitors elsewhere?
That's correct. I now work directly for the Boston Janitors Union, which is an immigrant union. It's comprised of about 90% of our workers are Latinos, and they work in the commercial office buildings downtown in Boston and in the universities throughout the Boston area.
And the wages, I'm sure, and health care are among the most important issues for janitors. How are your organizing efforts and your negotiations affected by the economic situation that we all find ourselves in?
Well, it has made things more intense, both in terms of putting fear into people's minds about losing a job in the case that they do decide to speak up and raise issues with management, but also in the sense that we're fighting cutbacks like fewer hours, which is a big issue for our members, many of whom already work part-time or 2 to 3 part-time jobs and are faced with cutbacks as is happening across the country. And again, the response is to bring the issues out to the public through any means that we can, and that has included a major strike about 8 months ago here in downtown Boston, in which thousands of workers walked off the job for a period of almost 1 month. So that was another intense period of activity and a very successful one, in the sense that we fought off cutbacks along health care and were able to win commitments to extending health care benefits to more workers.
The labor movement has rested for many, many years on the backs of idealistic young people, and I venture to say, like yourself, Aaron Bartley. Do you find a lot of other people like yourself involved in the movement now?
I would say there's certainly a growing consciousness in the time that I've done this work, which is about 8 years. I've seen more and more young people coming out of college with an awareness of the maldistribution of power and wealth in the society, and a decent analysis of how those relations will change, which is through organization and through the relevance of unions and bringing the message of what unions mean to the rank and file, and creating very democratic structures of leadership among the rank and file, which are inherently relevant to people's lives.
Aaron Bartley, thanks very much for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
Aaron Bartley is a union organizer for the Service Employees International Union, Chapter 615, and he spoke to us from his office in Boston. And Michael Yates is still with us from Portland, Oregon. I wanted to ask you, Aaron Bartley was talking about, tactics like strikes and things going back to the days of the 1930s and 40s, are those used much?
No, I think we've been at a low ebb as far as strikes are concerned. I don't have the exact – the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts out data on strike incidents, and so you could go to their website and look it up. But I think there's a lot – there are a lot fewer strikes. There are a lot fewer big strikes than there used to be. I mean, there are some good reasons for that. It's difficult to win a strike. An employer can hire permanent replacements. Employers might use a strike as an opportunity to move and what have you. But as Aaron said, there are cases when it's useful to do that, and unions sometimes, I think, have probably shied away from that kind of direct action. And oftentimes it works, as he said, and so it's something that probably there should be more of. I mean, there's a lot of things there should be more of in unions, in my opinion. I mean, unions don't do a very good job educating their members. A lot of unions don't have full-time education staff. They don't offer regular courses. They don't encourage their members to go to classes. Some do, and some don't. So that union members are left adrift. I mean, they don't know some basic economics, for example, since that's a subject close to my heart. They know very little about it, actually. And so unions have failed. They don't spend enough money on organizing. The SEIU is an exception. Most unions spend less than 5% of their budget on organizing. At one point, the Teamsters Union, I don't think this is true today, but at one time they spent more money on their national convention than they did on organizing, these big lavish affairs in Las Vegas. Oftentimes, it struck me, I don't know what's going on down there in North Carolina, but the Boilermakers Union organizing these workers, I mean, that's a little odd to me. I wonder if the Boilermakers doesn't look for hot shops, you know, or places they think they might organize, and instead of building up a grassroots campaign, they come in, send out some flyers, and so on and so forth, and they lose these elections, and it demoralizes everybody.
A lot of times unions
don't run the kind of campaigns they need to.
I was interested in something else that Aaron Bartley had to say about designing or creating a democratic union. Unions, over the years, have not developed a reputation for democracy within their own ranks.
Some are, some aren't. I mean, at the national level, the unions are not particularly democratic. Now, don't get me wrong. All unions are basically more democratic than any corporation. Corporations are not democratic. Unions are usually a little bit more democratic than that. And at the local level, a lot of unions are democratic. But at the national level, the participation of the rank and file in its operation, the chance for rank and file to run for office and win election isn't that high. I mean, even if you look at salaries, and I know that the president of a union has to have an expense account and has to have a travel budget and that sort of thing, but it's not uncommon for a union president to be making well into the six figures. The only union I know of that limits the salary of its top officials is the United Electrical Workers, which isn't in the AFL-CIO. I think that none of their officers can make more than the highest paid rank and file. Plus, they get expenses because you have to have that. So, you know, you get a little bit divorced from that. You see the SEIU local in New York, which was pretty corrupt at one point. I mean, this Gus Bavona, he was no longer in office, by the way. He's living in this huge palace in the union headquarters. He's making $400,000 to $500,000 a year. Well, the janitors aren't making anywhere near that. So there's this disconnect sometimes in unions, and I think that a little bit more democracy is going to be necessary. For example, the unions can provide Mr. Davis and Governor Davis in California with money. They can provide him with a lot of good staff and expertise. They can build up a media campaign for him. But the AFL-CIO can't get those rank and file school teachers who don't like Gray Davis very much, probably since there have been so many cutbacks in education, to go out and campaign for him or against this recall. So, you know, reaching down to the rank and file members Aaron said is critically important, and a lot of unions don't do a very good job of that, it seems to me, and they need to do a better job at that.
We're speaking with Michael Yates, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Go back to the phones. Phil joins us on the line from Mitchell, South Dakota.
Yes, long-time listener, first-time caller.
Nice to have you.
I'm a bit nervous. What I understand is that the rank and file, tend to be more conservative than the union leaders. Some unions are pro-abortion, pro-gay rights, and the like, and then there are these evangelical Christians who are rank and file, and their conscience says that we can't support this. You know, we can't support, you know, gay rights and abortion and stuff, and they just don't like it. And also, union leaders, you know, endorse candidates that they oppose. If you know what I mean.
Sure. Michael Yates, is the leadership in out of touch with its membership on those kinds of issues?
Well, sometimes it might be, but I think it all comes back to for example, packing house workers organized the stockyards in Chicago and Omaha in the 1930s, and they had to organize black workers to do that. Well, a lot of the white workers were not keen on black workers; they were racist. But the union worked and educated and built up a really commendable union whose symbol was a black and white hand joining together. So that even if the rank and file members are less liberal, let's say, than some of the union leaders, then it's the job of the union leaders to have education campaigns to talk to people. People are almost always willing to talk about things. You know what I mean? I don't think union members are generally any more conservative and probably more liberal than most. And so it's up to the union leadership to build a kind of rank and file movement. It should be the rank and file members' union. That's what a union is supposed to be. And you work through time to build up the kind of consciousness that makes a union strong, and you can overcome those divisive issues in a lot of cases. Certainly, union leaders might be in favor of pro-choice, and some members might not be. But so what?
Phil, do you pay any attention when your union says we endorse so and so?
See, I'm not a union member. I'm just observing, what I've read and what I've seen on TV.
I see. Okay, well, thanks very much for the call.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can talk to Bill, and Bill's in Minneapolis.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air, Bill.
Yes, I work for a major manufacturer. I'm non-union, and the company's going through financial difficulties at this point. And we've all made cutbacks, but the union seems to think that they should be exempt from the same cutbacks that all salaried people have played. Why do you think that they should be exempt from that, or do you think that they should?
Michael?
Well, I don't understand the situation. Are the non-supervisory workers in a union?
No supervisory.
We're losing Bill's cell phone, but I guess we're going to have to live with the question as we understand it now.
Well, I don't see why, if non-union workers are taking concessions, why union workers should have to take concessions. A union has to do the best it can to protect its members and set a good example for non-union workers in terms of what can be done. It's not that unions never make concessions. I mean, sometimes that's tactically necessary to do, and unions have made plenty of concessions in the past, taken enormous wage cuts, maybe more than they needed to take in some cases. There'd be very profitable companies asking for concessions and unions giving them the concessions when they maybe shouldn't have done so, but... the fact that unions are fighting to maintain their health care ought to be something that the rest of us ought to say, well, good for them. Maybe we can do the same thing, rather than saying, well, they should take cutbacks because I had to take cutbacks.
Michael Yates, a labor economist and the author of Why Unions Matter. A couple of more calls with him when we come back from a short break. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, totn@npr.org. We'll also bring you the strange story of isolated islands with a Stone Age culture. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Join Ira Flatow on Science Friday tomorrow for a conversation with Shirley Ann Jackson, president-elect of the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, about the graying of the sciences, plus an update on stem cell research. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Right now, we're wrapping up our conversation with Michael Yates, a labor economist and author of the book Why Unions Matter. And we're talking right now about the political clout of unions. And, Michael, do unions—obviously, you saw all the candidates in Chicago this week, the traditional, Democrats looking for the endorsement of the AFL-CIO. Obviously, they think it's important. How important is it?
Well, I think that, as Steve Greenhouse said, in terms of winning an endorsement, union members often hold a lot of positions in these local caucuses, like in New Hampshire and Iowa, and I'm sure in California and every other state too, because they tend to be a little bit more active than non-union members. So it's important in that sense. But whether or not it translates into union members voting, well, that depends. I think the new AFL-CIO under President Sweeney took office in 1995. They do a little bit better job of that now, you know, connecting to members. Probably not as good as it should be, but translating it into votes and then winning an election, I don't know. It seems to me that unions probably should concentrate a little bit more effort on organizing. I mean, how are you ever going to win in the South, for example, when there's such low union density there? I mean, the Republicans have a clear field there in the South these days. And when union density in North Carolina is 3.2%, that's not very many people to campaign and to organize. So it seems to me sometimes that rather than spending millions of dollars on presidential elections where the rewards are somewhat limited. I mean, let's not forget that from labor's perspective, Clinton was a strong champion of NAFTA, which unions have opposed and which have been basically detrimental to working people and certainly to union members.
There are people who will debate you on that, but go ahead.
Well, I don't know that can be debated that NAFTA is harmful to working people.
I'm sure I could find people to debate you, but let's get past it.
Okay. Well, so there, you know, I think that unions need to really have a platform, what they stand for, go with that rather than supporting candidates. I mean, they supported Gore way too early, it seems to me. So maybe they learned a lesson from that, and that's why they're not supporting Gephardt quite so soon. Gore hardly seemed to be a really pro-labor candidate, my point of view, but maybe the union leaders saw it a little bit differently. But I think sometimes their priority is a little bit backward. Instead of spending all these millions of dollars on a presidential election, local elections are probably more important. Fighting for national health care and that sort of thing are probably more important.
I just wanted to wind up with this one last email we got. This is from Per Fagerang in Portland, Oregon. He writes, "My first job was as a Norwegian maritime. My first union was a Norwegian maritime union when I was 15 and working a summer job on a freighter. I remember the first union meeting I attended. The crew was deciding whether to throw the cook overboard. They had mercy, and he was put off at the next port. Since then, I've been in six other unions. They have helped me on many occasions. Without them, my life would not be the same." It's a good way to end the conversation. Michael Yates, thanks very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Michael Yates, a labor economist, the author of Why Unions Matter. He was with us from the studios of member station KOPB in Portland, Oregon.